Rework is brought to you by Basecamp. Basecamp is a software tool for project teams. It centralizes everything the team needs to know, tasks, files, and discussions, in one easy-to-use place so nothing gets lost and nothing slips through the cracks. Learn more and sign up at basecamp.com.
Welcome to Rework, a podcast about the better way to work and run your business. I'm Waylon Wong.
And I'm Sean Hildner. Here at Basecamp, we're really big proponents of the 8-hour workday. You hear our co-founders, Jason Fried and David Heinemeier Hansen, all the time talking about not working more than 8 hours a day. We're not even supposed to have notifications turned on during evenings and weekends, even though I know for a fact you do, Waylon.
First of all, how dare you? Secondly, all this talk about the 8-hour workday got me wondering, how did we arrive at this number in the first place?
Actually, on this very podcast a few weeks ago, we had an episode where our guest credited Henry Ford with creating the 8-hour workday. That's something you see repeated on social media, too. But it's just not the case.
Today on Rework, I sit down with Emily Twarog. She's an associate professor at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign in the School of Labor and Employment Relations, and she specializes in labor studies and labor history. She's here to talk about the history of the 8-hour workday and its shockingly brief heyday in America. If, like me, you went through 12-plus years of the American public education system without really learning anything about organized labor, I think you'll find this conversation very interesting. For starters, Emily says that a lot of historians look at the great upheaval of 1886 as the starting point. In Chicago alone that year, some 88,000 workers went on strike to demand the 8-hour workday. But Emily likes to begin the story in the early 1800s in Lowell, Massachusetts.
First American factories are in the Massachusetts area along the riverways because they're dependent on the river for the energy to run the factories. And these are our first textile factories. They hire farm girls to come work. And they figure, okay, we can hire these farm girls because they'll be obedient and docile and, you know, they're nearby, they speak English. These women are working 12, 13, 14-hour days in the factory, 6 days a week. They have Sundays off. They wake up usually around 4, 4:30. They go work for a couple hours, come back to the boarding house that they live in, they're required to live in, eat breakfast in like 15 minutes, go back to the factory, work till, you know, midday meal, go back to the factory and work until nightfall. And so they're working really hard and they begin to organize for higher wages, safer working conditions and shorter days. So that would be, I would argue, like kind of the first beginnings, but that's early 1800s.
Did they find any success in what they were advocating for?
Yes and no. So, you know, they started publishing a newspaper called The Lowell Offering. You know, the publication was a mix of like poetry and short stories, but it was also political where they would write about work issues. They would then petition the Massachusetts legislature to cut the work hours. They did begin to see some traction. However, very quickly, we have an influx of Irish immigrants. And so the owners of the mills figure, oh, okay, well, these women are starting to cost us more. They're starting to create more problems. So let's just replace them with low-wage immigrant work. When it really gets off the ground is when you see full-blown manufacturing up and down the East Coast, heading out west to Chicago. You know, Chicago is seen as the future. You know, the city burned, we rebuilt very quickly. So we have all of the sort of pioneering architects coming here to build the first skyscrapers. And we have massive industry as well as agriculture, as well as steel. And then, of course, we are like the crossroads for the rail tracks. So Chicago's where the 8-hour day really kicks off. The slogan was 8 hours for work, 8 hours for rest, and 8 hours for what you will. The idea being you're making a lot of money off of us and we deserve to earn this wage, but then also to have a high quality of life. And so that was really the motivation behind the 8-hour day, because at this point people were working 6 days a week, 12, 13, 14 hours a day. And this is, of course, before we have any kind of labor legislation that would mandate overtime pay or anything like that. And the conditions were atrocious.
And this is across industries, any all kinds of factories.
This is across industries, yeah. So like where we are right now recording, this whole area was the garment factory area. Of course, we're also the meatpacking capital. So meatpacking, which is amongst the worst jobs, steel, you know, equipment manufacturing. So McCormick Reaper Works was manufacturing farming equipment. McCormick Reaper Works you know, had a lot of unskilled laborers on their assembly lines, but they were trying to eliminate the highly skilled workers, the iron workers, who created all the molds that they needed to do their work. And the iron workers went out on strike. And it was a very lengthy strike. And a lot of activists fighting for the 8-hour day went to support the strike. That's actually the strike that kicked off the Haymarket Square massacre, and the big fight for the 8-hour day all happened right around that same time in 1886. You know, the Lowell mills and all the textile mills continue to expand in New England well into the 20th century. So you see later on organizing efforts that are successful in the early 20th century that are still predominantly female. I mean, women tend to be textile workers by the point of like the uprising of 1912. You have predominantly women working, but it was more of a mixed immigrant workforce. So not just farm girls, right? Italians, Irish, Polish. And during the 1912 Bread and Roses strike, it was that similar campaign of like, we deserve bread, you know, we deserve a wage, but we deserve a good life as well, the Roses. And so that was a very, very powerful strike that gained national attention.
How did the factory owners sell the idea of such a long workday to, let's say, the general public, which would be paying attention to this kind of thing? I mean, what was the kind of language that you would see coming out of kind of the people at the top of the ladder? Would they say, this is just how many hours needs to be worked if we want to maintain production at a certain level? Or, I mean, it's like, how did they kind of try to sell it to the public?
I mean, these are the first factories. These are the first wage jobs, right? I mean, we take it for granted that you get a job and you get a paycheck. This was the first time that was happening. People didn't earn paychecks. They had small family farms. They bartered. They, you know, sold goods, maybe in the market. You know, they ran their own businesses. People didn't have a model for anything else. For the mill girls, those jobs were seen as supplemental. I have this kind of like made up family when I teach about like the wool mill girl family, where it's like mom and dad end up having a bunch of kids and they have a bunch of girls. Like, girls are expensive. They're seen as not profitable. You don't hand down your land to girls. If you want to marry them off, you have to have a dowry of some kind, not like high end dowry, but like you need to have some land. You need to have a chest full of, you know, things to start off your household. If you have five daughters, that's an expensive proposition if you're just a small landowner in New England. You know, mills start to post these advertisements in the local broadsheets and in the little stores in the communities to say, here is an opportunity for your daughter before she gets married to earn all this extra money for the family. So it's really seen as an opportunity to increase the family's wealth so that they can marry off their daughters. So it wasn't so much selling the idea of the work itself as this is an opportunity to earn more, right? And the economy is changing, because at the same time, what's happening is factories are developing so that you can produce things in larger quantities more quickly, and people are less and less relying on homemade goods and now able to go to the general store and purchase something that's made for them. Or they can purchase more of something, right? Like more dishes or more forks and spoons, whereas your family may only have one of each for each family member, right? That kind of mass production begins to make things more affordable and converts us into what we now know of ourselves as a consumer economy. But the cost of that, right, is that artisans lose their jobs, so they have no other means to support themselves but to go work in factory labor. Quickly, people realize this is an unsustainable way of living. And so organizing begins right off the bat, but they're also in a difficult situation where you have to pay your bills and you have to earn a wage, right? You have to feed your family. Because there's always somebody who's willing to work for less. As soon as that workforce begins to agitate and organize, you replace them with a different workforce, right? So the capitalists, you know, the factory owners have a big advantage over the workforce. And the massive amount of immigration and the end of the Civil War and Great Migration from the South to the North give them the advantage to be able to sort of divide and conquer the workforce to replace folks who are resisting the status quo.
In the agitation for the 8-hour workday, was that usually the kind of headline demand in a list of other demands around better working conditions, safer working conditions? Was it usually kind of part of like a package, and then 8-hour day was like just a nice, elegant way to kind of summarize it?
Yeah. I mean, people wanted a shorter day for the same amount of wage, right? So we want a shorter day, but we still want to earn the same amount. So if you're going to cut our day from 12 to 8 hours a day, we still want to earn what we would earn at 12 hours a day, right? We want safer working conditions. That's a huge, huge piece of it. But you're right. I mean, it was like a good tagline, right? Like a good hashtag, like the 8 hour day. So it worked really well for them. But yeah, it was definitely an umbrella term that meant a higher wage, a breadwinner wage, right? The idea being that the family norm should be the man works, the woman stays home. So a husband should be able to earn enough to feed his family without the wife having to work. So it meant making sure that he was working shorter hours, still probably 6 days a week.
When did we get the weekend?
It's kind of it's an end result of union contracts. So you start to see that in the 40s after World War II, when we're at peak unionization in the United States. You know, you have the passage of the Fair Labor Standards Act in the 1930s. The National Labor Relations Act gives all private sector workers the right to organize, which is an important distinction because it excluded two segments of private sector, which was agricultural workers and domestic workers, and didn't include public sector workers, of which there was an increasing number. So after World War II comes to a close, the economy is booming as a result of the war. We have relatively high union density, right? 1 in 3 private sector workers are unionized. They're able to negotiate this idea of like the 8 hour day, giving folks overtime after either 40 hours of work a week or 8 hours in one day, and the idea of 2 days off in a row. You don't get that idea of like the American middle class standard of living until the late 40s. Yeah. And it's a blip, really. I mean, it's like 50s, 60s, and then it starts to decline in the 70s.
So that's like the whole golden era of like the true 8 hour workday is just like a few decades in the
pretty much
mid-20th century.
Yeah. I mean, people think of it as like, this is what I deserve, right? Like the American dream is that I'm going to, you know, forget about getting like filthy rich, right? A house, 2 cars, you know, being able to retire, going on a nice vacation, or you can afford to buy groceries and your prescription drugs. You know, you don't have to worry about money on a day-to-day basis, right? Where you don't live paycheck to paycheck and you have some level of comfort. In order to do that in America today, you have to earn a lot of money. So we're really only able to pull that off for a couple of decades. And even then, you have to think about it through an intersectional lens of like what Black workers have access to, what immigrant workers have access to, what Latino workers. I mean, but the bottom line is that we do have high enough union density and jobs are good enough that they're raising even those non-unionized jobs up. There's an expectation when you go to work that your workplace is going to provide you with health insurance, that they're going to provide you with what was then a pension, now a 401k, right? Like that was an expectation, even without a college degree, that you could go work at a place and it was their job, because we don't have universal health care here, to get your health care through your job and to get, you know, some vacation time and to get some kind of retirement, usually a pension. And when public sector workers started unionizing in the 50s and 60s, those jobs opened up way more opportunities for Black workers, which is why you see a much larger percentage of Black workers in public sector jobs. Like the post office becomes like a haven for Black workers, and those become unionized jobs that also offer those kinds of benefits. So that's the expectation for work. But, you know, my undergraduates like think that they're going to get all that because that's a bill of goods we've been sold, right? This is what you're going to get. And it's less and less likely that that's what you'll get if you don't have a union involved.
So, what happened to the short-lived 8-hour day? Emily gets into it right after the break. But first, I'm going to turn things over to Basecamp's head of product strategy, Ryan Singer, to tell you a little more about Basecamp.
Yeah, so I was talking to one of our customers, and he runs a nonprofit. They do social work for refugees. They had a really interesting situation where he's trying to fix their communication problems that are starting to bubble up as they grow. But it's really hard to get everybody into the office to talk about something like software. Holding these training meetings and trying to gather everybody together to learn software was really interrupting and getting in the way of the social work that the staff was trying to do. They felt like every hour that they weren't in the field was an hour wasted that was affecting somebody's life. He had tried actually on three different occasions to try and put some different software into place. And every time it was kind of this like, ugh, like you want us to learn another piece of software. and none of them really stuck. So there was kind of some stuff in one app and some stuff in another app. And they started to grow and they had a few more people and they had more projects happening. And then all of a sudden, it really kind of reached a tipping point when they missed a funding deadline because somebody put a message in the wrong app. They put a message in an app that kind of people weren't looking at and they missed a really key deadline. And then for him, this was the moment of like, all right, look, we've got some more hires coming. And if I don't fix this, like we're going to break. He was hesitant to even look at software again because he was afraid of this hump he was going to have to go through to train everybody and get everybody out of the field and into the office. But he does a search. He comes across Basecamp. And when he gets to the How It Works page on our marketing site, he sees this video that in less than 3 minutes walks through the whole app. And he says, wow, I've looked at other tools and they had hours and hours of training material. And here I watched a 3 minute video and I understood everything end to end. So he's thinking, okay, I'm not going to have to actually pull them in for a whole day. I can just show them this short video. Everybody's going to be able to understand it. Everybody's going to start using it right away. This gave him the confidence to actually give it a shot. He was able to tell his staff, look, you've seen the video, you get how it works. Just start putting your to-dos in these projects and now nothing is going to slip through the cracks and we're not going to have that problem again. And everybody did. They were able to delete Slack. They were stopped using Google Drive. They kind of put an internal ban on email for just messages between staff. And they even had a couple other apps too on the side that they were all able to totally clean out. Everything's just in Basecamp. And this gave them the confidence that they weren't going to miss something again. For us as the makers of Basecamp, we're always trying to look at it through our customers' eyes to really understand what's important about it and why does it work for them. We've known that having everything in one place prevents you from losing things and for things slipping through the cracks. But this helped us to understand also, what does it mean for Basecamp to be easy? Easy doesn't just mean that you can figure it out. Easy means that it's fast to learn so that you don't have to waste everybody's time.
Basecamp is the all-in-one app for organizing your work and communicating company-wide. Oh, and it's extremely easy to use. Give it a shot with your team at basecamp.com.
I mean, what happened to put an end to that brief halcyon period?
I mean, a lot of things, you know. There was a decline in unionization. We saw, you know, more automation. I mean, you know, you don't need that many people to do the same kind of work. You know, free trade. Free trade had a huge impact. Those are all things that were just going to change as the economy changed, as technology changed. I would argue that a lot of labor unions kind of sat on their haunches and, like, didn't think 10, 20 years down the road, like, what is the impact of this going to be? Like, what should we anticipate and how should we change? I think if they had, there would have been less slippage with union membership. There would have been more retraining programs earlier on. But the other piece of where I'm critical of labor movement is that they also stopped organizing. In the 30s, the 40s, they were organizing everybody. And it was a radical organizing drive. And then we had the rise of the Cold War, which was a huge factor. So we were terrified of anything that even sniffed of collectivism, right, which a labor union does. There was legislation that was passed in 1947 that said if you're a union leader, you have to sign an anti-communism pledge. As we saw manufacturing decrease and the service sector increasing, what the labor movement should have been doing was organizing all those workers. But instead, they kind of held on to, like, the heyday mentality of the 50s and 60s and blamed immigrants for driving wages down. So instead of supporting immigrant reform in the 80s, they opposed it. Instead of organizing those new workers and turning service sector jobs, which are essentially what manufacturing jobs were in the 30s and 40s, sort of turning them into middle class jobs, now they're scrambling, right? Now it's the 21st century and it's like, oh, now we have to organize all these workers. It's like they should have been organizing them in the 70s and 80s. You also saw a huge increase in office work. By the mid-80s, you know, you have 55% of adult women are in the workforce as opposed to their generation earlier, which was like one in three, around 33%. They're in the workforce a little bit because of feminism, but mostly because their husbands are no longer earning wages that can support the family. So you have 7 million women working in predominantly non-union, low pay, low career ladder to no career ladder office jobs, right, to supplement the lost wages of the 70s. So that's another place where, you know, the labor movement began to try to organize but wasn't hugely successful in organizing those workers. So there's a lot of different things. But I do believe when I hear the talking heads on the radio talking about, like, well, what happened to the American dream? Why can't our children, you know, work in a job and support their family and not have student loan debt and be able to afford childcare? I mean, there's a couple of reasons, but the one thing they never really talk about is union decline. And the reality is that employers don't give you health insurance because they, like, want to do it out of the bottom of their hearts, because we believe that that's the right thing to do. They do it because they've been pressured to do it, and we don't have universal health care, and collective bargaining agreements required that you do it, and so all the other employers had to do it. But as soon as that starts slipping away, employers are going to figure out how to maximize their profits. And there's also a whole element of shareholder influence. So you have demands from shareholders who want better returns. So how do you get better returns? Well, I mean, you could cut CEO wages. You could say to shareholders, you know, we're going to offer a pension and really good health insurance, so you're just going to have to get 10% less. That's not going to fly, right? No one's going to invest in your business. So where do they cut it from? They cut it from the bottom. And without any kind of government regulation stepping in to keep that from happening. So with the election of Ronald Reagan and this idea of trickle-down economics, we still have that belief. Like, if you just work hard enough, you'll do great. And there's a few enough people that show us that that's maybe possible, right?
Like, we latch onto the exceptions and the outliers.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Because that, we want to believe that, right? We want to believe that if I just work hard enough, I'm going to hit it big. We have other business leaders who are the exception, but we then tag that onto every single business leader, right? And because union density is now hovering around 11%, so that's 1 in 10 workers, that's not enough leverage to pressure other employers to keep it up. And because the government has remained very distant, both under Democratic and Republican administrations since the 80s.
Do you think that the, like, interrogating the 8-hour workday in this current economy, is that a useful question to be asking? Or when you want to rethink the current economy we have to make it more equitable, do you think we should be looking at other questions?
I mean, I think it's still a central question. It's a matter of, like, kind of how we talk about it. But I think at the end of the day, what workers really want is, whether you're working in, you know, an hourly job that you kind of, like, leave at the workplace, or a job that you're not highly invested in versus a career, people want discrete time that they work and that time that they're home, and then time that they get to sleep. And so that is essentially the 8-hour day. That doesn't exist anymore. I have a very good job. You know, I'm a university professor. I make a good wage. I feel guilty, you know, when I don't check my email on the weekends. There's an expectation that, like, because we have devices in our hands, we're going to constantly be responding to emails. We expect an instant response. Like, God forbid I, like, get an email on Friday and don't answer it until Monday. You know, I've actually been trying to be much more conscientious of this, to say, you know what, I'm not going to check my email on the weekends. And that's in, you know, a very successful professional job where it really, I mean, I'm an academic at the end of the day. Who really cares if I answer my email or not? The world is not going to cease to exist. But we also have the problem that people, you know, when they were fighting for the 8-hour day, were working too many hours. For a lot of low-wage workers, the issue now is that they're not getting enough hours. So for workers in fast food industry or the, you know, the service sector, one of the issues is there's all of these computer programs that, you know, McDonald's uses this technology. Like, okay, based on what was happening in downtown Chicago last year at this time, we served X number of meals. So we need X number of workers today between 8 and 10, and then we need a bunch of workers again between 6 and 10 at night. So workers are scheduled to work from 8 to 10, then they don't have any hours, and then they're expected to come back between 6 and 10. They're not being given a 8 to 10 workday, right, where they would actually earn overtime. They're being told to come to work for a couple hours, go home, and then come back to work for a couple hours, these split shifts. Or because under Obamacare, businesses, if you work 38 hours or more, businesses are now expected to provide health care or pay into a health care fund of some kind or pay into the marketplace. You know, workers are being kept under 38 hours. So now workers are piecing together 2-3 jobs, right? And then you have, of course, the whole gig economy, right? So it's like, okay, great. So I work at McDonald's. I have a car. So I'm going to go in the morning. Then I'm going to do Instacart from 11 to 6, and then I'll go back into work. So you eventually, you basically just work like a 12-hour day, and then, oh, you know what? I'm also an Uber driver, so I'll just drive a couple hours until maybe 1 a.m. You've worked three jobs, and you've earned no benefits. You have no paid time off. You have no sick leave. You have no retirement, and you're living paycheck to paycheck.
Right.
But you've worked your ass off.
Right, but like you're still teetering like at the edge of the abyss always.
Always. And then you have people saying, well, you don't deserve $15 an hour because it's not skilled labor. I have union members who say this to me a little. It's just flipping burgers. But, you know, that's what people said about auto workers. It's just screwing bolts. That's not skilled work. They're easily disposable. And that's how the employers thought of them, is easily disposable work. They were not highly skilled. I mean, I worked in food service for 15 years. Working the Burger King drive-thru is not actually that easy. It is actually requires very good multitasking skills. But people assume that this is, you know, not difficult work. Is it becoming a lawyer and arguing a case in court? No, of course not. But it is still a job that requires some skill set. So yeah, you've worked 12, 13-hour day, just like folks in the late 1800s, and you don't have any benefits. The job's kind of dangerous. You get a car accident. You could hurt your back. You could slip on the ice. Any number of things could happen. You could burn yourself with scalding hot oil at McDonald's while you make French fries. But you don't have health insurance. You don't qualify for Family Medical Leave Act because you don't work for an employer for a certain number of time. You don't earn enough hours. So you don't even have like unpaid leave time that would guarantee you job security. It's really no different than being like a minor in 1890.
I mean, we've just come, like we've like come all the way back.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, really, we have.
That's so bleak.
It's super bleak. It's super bleak. And the difference, I argue, in my research is that we had a much stronger sense of collective identity as workers and as people struggling before, say, 1970s than we do today. People are very individualistic and they're very ashamed. People are genuinely ashamed that they can't pay their bills, they can't make ends meet, that they don't want to tell anybody that. You're not going to disclose that I haven't paid my, you know, if you're lucky enough to have a mortgage, I haven't paid my mortgage for 3 months, or, you know, I had to ask for financial aid for my kid to go to like after school programming, or we actually go to the food pantry for our groceries. Back in the day, it actually was like people relied on each other. Someone was getting evicted, everyone stood on the doorstep and kept the police from evicting them. Today, you lose your house and people are like just worried about their own housing value, right? And they think, oh, well, they shouldn't have bought such an expensive house.
And we equate poverty, we like tie it up with morality.
Yeah, yeah, that you are lazy, that you haven't done what you need to do because this is a meritocracy and you just have to work harder. But what's changed, you know, I mentioned deregulation earlier. I mean, we had much more government intervention. I mean, the difference between the 1950s and today, or the 1890s, was during the 1930s, under FDR, the New Deal introduced all sorts of government regulations. And the government held corporations accountable and made them pay taxes. You know, Walmart opens up and they don't pay any taxes. You know, Amazon, it just opened up in Skokie where I live, and like, they're not paying any taxes. Those large companies, if they paid even a fraction of what corporations had to pay under President Eisenhower, who was Republican president in the 1950s, we would have tons of money. You know, we could have regulations that kept jobs in the country, right? Oh, you want that tax break, then you need to guarantee that X number of jobs are not going to be exported. Having representatives on the National Labor Relations Board that are truly open to, you know, workers' rights. Increase employee ownership programs. I mean, there's a lot of different options, so it doesn't have to be bleak. We have the models. Like, the models exist for success. But the question is like, isn't enough money enough money? You know, if somebody's working three jobs, shouldn't they have access to a very minimum standard of living? The reality is your kid gets the flu and is out of school for 3 days, you could lose your job. Mm-hmm. Somebody appendix bursts and you don't have health insurance, you're going to go bankrupt.
I mean, it's interesting, this economic reality we have now where people are working multiple low-wage jobs, none of which give them benefits. I mean, does that, you think, require some rethinking on the organization, the labor side, to be like, well, we traditionally have organized unions in terms of like everyone who does a certain particular job, right? Mm-hmm. And you have, for example, like the Fight for 15 or something that's like has been very good at organizing fast food workers, but fast food workers are also like driving Uber and they're also picking up groceries for Instacart. And I know like at Instacart, there's also like a movement afoot to try to organize. And I wonder, it's like, do we need some kind of like completely radically rethought union just to represent everyone in like the precariat?
I think organized labor is trying to figure that out now. The Fight for 15 is a great example of, you know, a campaign that hasn't necessarily resulted in unionization of, you know, thousands of workers. But I don't think we would have seen all of the minimum wage increases on a municipal state level without the Fight for 15 campaign. So the challenge is when you have everybody spread out. So like the Uber drivers, Lyft, you know, all of that kind of services that we all use at this point, right? Because it's become such a fabric of our lives. That's where the government needs to come in, saying we have a new economy here. We have this like service economy that looks very different than it did in, you know, 1920 or even 1970. How are we going to adjust our policies? The fact is that like we need to update our idea of what an independent contractor is. Like we really probably just need to get rid of that at this point.
Right. And just make them employees so that they're,
Like you can't, like, we can't be a nation with like no actual workers. That's what we're heading towards. So if we don't change what we mean when we say independent contractor, then we're going to basically have a country that like exists with like no actual employees, right? Just a bunch of individuals like trying to scrape it together. As a nation that it has a responsibility to the people in the nation, right? And the workforce, we're going to have to make some changes.
Rework is produced by Waylon Wong and me, Sean Hildner. Music for the show is by Clipart. We are on Twitter at Rework Podcast. Emily Twarog is on Twitter at eTwarog. That's E-T-W-A-R-O-G. She's the author of the 2017 book, Politics of the Pantry, Housewives, Food, and Consumer Protest in 20th Century America.
I read a couple books to prepare for this episode that I recommend. One was Beaten Down, Worked Up by Stephen Greenhouse, which is a very readable history of the American labor movement through the present day. And the other is On the Clock, What Low-Wage Work Did to Me and How It Drives America Insane by Emily Gundelsberger. She's a journalist who takes jobs at an Amazon warehouse, a call center, and a McDonald's, and it's so much worse than I imagined. I will link to those books in the show notes, which you can find at rework.fm. Do not buy these books on Amazon.
Rework is brought to you by Basecamp. Basecamp puts everything you need to get work done in one place. It's the calm, organized way to manage projects, work with clients, and communicate company-wide. Check it out for yourself at basecamp.com.